I looked about, like that fellow on that peak in Darien. "Do you mean to say Marilyn's given you the cold mutton? Easily fixed, I should say. Fly to her side with a bouquet of the best and tell her she's the apple's eye. Throw in a sonnet or such like. Can't miss. Girls like Marilyn are easy prey to a well-turned quatrain." "It's not Marilyn, you oaf." He drew himself up, though he still reached no great heights. "I love another." "Another?" I goggled, or boggled, or whatever it is one does when confronted by life's absurdities. "Another what?" "A goddess," he said. "She walks in beauty like the something-something, I can't remember the rest, but she's the real McCoy, Barty." I took an involuntary step back, then a voluntary one for good measure, and said, "I mean to say, old chum, it's not on, is it? A broken engagement, that's one thing, but a putting asunder. Besides which, an enraged buffet is not a factor to be left out of one's plans. Disemboweling's not out of the question." "I don't care, Bertie," he said. "The heart has its imperatives." "Oh, it does it?" I said. "Well, Marilyn has the aspect of the tiger. Not the imitation, the real thing." He had deflated again. "It doesn't matter," he said. "For though I love with a passion to shake the ages, the goddess does not smile on me." Light dawned. Not the real thing, of course. The sun would have needed a trowel to penetrate the clouds that lowered over us, but the figurative glimmer of comprehension. "Hold on there, Baldy. Are you saying that you love another, but she does not care to return the serve?" "I am," he said, brightening a little. "You always have the right phrase at your fingertips, don't you, Barty? That's why I asked Slithy to bring you." "You want me to tell you what to say to win her heart?" It seemed a rum business. One doesn't go around helping chums to overturn the marital apple cart. Besides, there was the prospect of an unmarried Marilyn Buffett just over the horizon. When she and Baldy had been on the outs during their tortuous courtship, the blue Buffett orbs had fixed on Bartholomew as her second string in the matrimonial target shoot. The idea of exposing myself once more to the predatory aims of the Buffett turned my knees to water and my bowels to jelly. Or perhaps it was the other way round. Either way, it was not a fate that invited a forward rush. "I won't advise you," I said. "My lips are sealed." "I don't want you to advise me," he said. "Oh, well, good." I heaved a sigh of relief, rather a heavy one. "I want you," he said, "to speak to her." "To her?" I said, water and jelly galloping back into the picture. "To Marilyn?" "Not to Marilyn. Stop talking about Marilyn. She is past and forgotten, one with Nineveh and Tyre. I want you to speak to her." His pale fingers fluttered in the general direction of the dark pond. I turned in the direction indicated, peering through the curtain of rain to see if there was someone standing on the other side of the water. I could see nothing. "Where is she?" I said. "And, a salient point, who is she?" Instead of answering, he squatted by the edge of the water. Then he extended a hand and patted the surface of the pool with his fingertips, in what appeared to be a deliberate rhythm, though Baldy couldn't have kept a beat in a jam jar. After a moment, apparently satisfied, he rose and stood back. "I'm sorry, Baldy, but I don't quite see..." "Shh," he said, gesturing towards the pond. "Look!" Out in the centre, a circular ripple appeared. Then it became a V, making toward where we loitered on the shore. It seemed a very determined sort of V, the kind one sees in films that feature brawny-chested types in loincloths, who have nothing better to do with their afternoons than wrestle crocodiles that leap upon them from grey, greasy rivers. Grey and greasy, incidentally, made a pretty good description of the colour and texture of Baldy's pond. I took a judicious step back, leaving Baldy to remain in status quo, drooped over the water's edge like a willow mourning the loss of its will to live, the V continued to close upon him. "Baldy," I said, meaning to add a warning, but at that moment the surface at the point of the V broke. From it emerged a green triangular head, roughly the size and shape of a ditch digger's spade, except that it had two large and golden eyes about where you'd expect to find them. As the head rose from the water, I saw that from under the lower jaw protruded branch-like organs. I had a vague memory of a much younger Baldy Spots Binkle pointing to some little lizard in a tank and inviting me to notice its gills, an invitation that I am glad to say I succinctly declined. The head was now well clear of the surface. Below it were two narrow shoulders that sat above a slim and sinuous torso. As the apparition reached the shore and emerged from the water, it produced a pair of slender arms and a matching set of pins, both ending in webbed digits. A long, glistening tail, sporting a kind of fin that actually began at the nape of the creature's longish neck, provided the denouement. Words failed. I emitted a sound that began with a g and ended with an ack, with a kind of hiccup to bridge the two. Baldy shot me the sort of look an aunt gives a fellow who's just spilled tea on the best Persian, and said, "God's sake, Barty, stop gawking and say how do you do to Shilistrata." I closed my mouth, opened it, still found nothing of use in it, and closed it again. But then I managed to rally the routed remnants of my vocabulary. How do you do? I said. "Shilistrata, is it? Charming. Unusual." "Don't be an ass, Barty," said Baldy. "I doubt it's at all unusual on Venus." He turned to the, and let's not beat around the shrubbery, she was a newt, and said, "You'll have to forgive my chum. He can be a touch provincial, don't you know?" That was a bit stiff coming from a fellow who'd spent most of his life messing about in rural puddles, and who, to my certain knowledge, had not shown his piscine fizz in London more than once in 10 years. But I let it pass, because the creature from the pond had now turned her remarkable eyes, round, amber with flecks of silver, on me, and at the same time a voice spoke in my head, saying, "You are the Barty, the Gloucester." "Well, yes," I said, "so to speak. And you are the Shilistrata, I believe. How do you do?"
"It is what the Archibald calls me," the voice said.
"It's a perfectly good name," said Baldy. I had a passing recollection that Shilistrata might have been the moniker he had bestowed on one of his tank denizens back in our school days.
"Would you like to call me something else?"
said the voice, which, now that I focused on it, I realized was rich and warm, calling up an image of honey being stirred into cream. "No, no," I said. "Shilistrata's just the ticket." She smiled at that. I should clarify that assertion on 2 points. Point the first, although Shilistrata showed none of the anatomical bits and pieces associated with the divine female form, still less any fripperies of feminine fashion, being clad only in her mottled green skin, every aspect of her bespoke the fairer sex. Not least the voice, which had the sort of mellifluosity, if that's the word I want, that would have set a troubadour to swooning. Point the second. When she opened her mouth, exhibiting more pearlies than one is used to, indeed two needlish ranks of them, above and below, along with a tongue that put me in mind of a pink bonnet ribbon, the only gentlemanly response was to receive the action as a smile, and to send one back across the net. "Well," I said, then "well" again. I realized that I was rocking back and forth on toe and heel, something I'm prone to do when conversation sails into the doldrums, as one does when a rear tire becomes surrounded by mud. A gentle rocking eases the old two-seater up and out and back to cruising the byways. On the heels of that realization came another. Someone was hissing. At first I thought it might be Shilistrata. Then, realizations now coming thick and fast, I grasped that the sound was coming out of Baldy. He was saying "hist" in a stage whisper, obviously to get my attention. I turned to him, and he said, "For goodness sake, Barty, speak up!" At first, I thought that he was trying to tell me that the talking newt was a little hard of hearing. No shell-like ears were in evidence, but then he made the back of the fingers gesture in her direction, and the final realization of the occasion now made its entrance. Baldy wanted me to speak up for him and to her. A Gloucester is always willing to come to the aid of an old school pal. It's what we're bred for, after all. But in this instance, a clear path to the goal was lacking. I turned Baldy's way, put up a hand to shield my lips, and said, "About what, exactly?" I was rewarded with the sight of Baldy impersonating an exasperated fish. "About me, of course!" "About you?" I said. Then the penny hit the bottom of the chute. "You don't mean as a suitor?" "I mean nothing less." "But Baldy, she's a—" I threw an apologetic glance Shilistrata's way and lowered my voice to a whisper. "A newt, or at least a newtess." "I am aware of that, Barty," he said. "Well then," I said, "how exactly would you expect matters to work themselves out? I mean to say, what is your goal?" Now I saw an exasperated fish dealing with an obtuse interlocutor.
"Matrimony, of course."
"But Baldy, she's a newt."
"Stop saying that," he said.
"There's nothing wrong with my organs of perception, and I should think that if either one of us is likely to recognize a newt on sight, it would be I." There was clearly something wrong with at least one of Archibald Spotsbinkle's organs, and I would have taken odds on its being the one stewing behind his fish eyes. I made one last attempt.
"A newt, Baldy! You're not even the same order, or genius, or whatever it is."
"Oh, that," he said, with a roll of the eyes. "We're above all that. This is a marriage of souls, a union of essences. We will conjoin on a spiritual plane, in an exalted merger of the spirit." He fluttered those dismissive fingers again. "It's beyond your comprehension, Barty." It certainly was. I found myself blinking, at a loss as to how to make further headway. It came to me that now would be a suitable moment to enlist the cerebral powers of Greaves. If ever there was a fellow who could think his way, or mine for that matter, out of a tight spot, Greaves topped the list. I turned and looked about, hoping that that well-stocked head might be somewhere in view. But that recourse was not on offer. And now Baldy seized my arm and hissed, or histed, at me once more.
"Tell her, Barty!"
"Tell her what?"
"About me, you fathead! About my qualities."
"Oh," I said. "Rather." "Righto, Baldy. I turned to the sinuous green form, which had been swaying before me like one of those cobras summoned from baskets by near-naked flautists on the subcontinent.
I began, then followed with a, "Well," and a, "Here's how it is."
But then the spring ran dry. I turned to Baldy and said,
"I say, Spotsbinkle, it would be a dash sight easier to praise you in your absence. One feels constrained when the subject of the paean is hanging about, snagging every word."
Now it was his turn to blink.
"Really?" he said. "It hadn't occurred."
More likely, he'd had so little experience of being lionized in his absence or presence that the ins and outs eluded him. But now he nodded and said,
"Righto, Barty. I'll leave you to get on with it."
And with a nod and a bow to the newtess, he shuffled off towards the house. Shilistrata gave no sign of having noticed his departure. Instead, her lambent eyes remained fixed on yours truly, and her swaying became even more pronounced.
There certainly didn't seem to be much wrong with her backbone, assuming she had one. She would have won the first-in-class ribbon for limberness. I had an odd passing thought. Baldy had used to go on about how newts courted each other by wriggling and tail-shaking. I suppressed the query as non-germane.
"Well, Shillistrata," I said, "you've caught yourself a first-rater in our Archibald. Why, when it comes to knowledge of the ways of pond-dwellers, you couldn't have struck more lucky. Backed a sure winner, so you have."
Her motions now became alarmingly fluid. There was something almost hypnotic about the side-to-siding, and it seemed as if a song was humming in my brain, and not to any toe-tapping Charleston or black-bottom rhythm, but more on the louche and languid side of the dance floor. Nonetheless, there was a job to be done.
I doubt, I pressed on, that there's a better newt man in all of England than Archibald Spots Binkle. My advice is to snap him up, and sharply, before some other newtess tosses a lasso round his angular form. I paused there, expecting some kind of rejoinder. Instead, all I got was more swaying and humming. I found that my own head was moving in concert with her motions, and that the song she was humming was growing more and more entrancing. I was thinking that that was just the song I'd always wanted to hear, though I hadn't known it until now. And now her voice was speaking. I thought it was quite a good trick to be able to speak and hum at the same time. Beat the pants off Flinders Bunchup's celebrated turn at the Inertia Club Christmas Saturnalia 2 years back, when he sang the Dark Town Strutter's Ball while juggling an entire set of condiment dishes.
"Come to me," she was saying. "You are the one."
"The one what?" I managed. But now it was not just my head that was moving in a mysterious way. My whole body was in syncopation with hers.
"Come," she said. "It is the time. You are chosen."
Still bonelessly undulating, she was backing towards the dark pond. Yet somehow the distance between us had not grown. That puzzled me for a moment until I realized that I was swaying along after her. It seemed to be exactly the right thing to do. I had the vaguest inkling that I was supposed to be engaged in some other task, something to do with Baldy. The word qualities tried to make itself known, but the humming and the swaying played trump upon trump. I took another step. At that moment a blast of icy cold liquid slapped against my face, instantly sobering me up.
"I beg your pardon, sir," said Greaves. "I was bringing you a glass of refreshment and stumbled on the uneven ground." A firm hand took my arm as he said, "Please let me lead you to the house, where we will locate a towel and undo the damage."
The strong grip now drew me steadily away from the pond. The humming and speaking faded to a dwindle. Then suddenly the Gloucester head was once more illuminated by its customary clarity. I looked at Greaves and saw him regarding me with what I took to be a judgmental eye. I withdrew my arm from his grasp.
"A towel, Greaves?" I said, then added, "Pshaw! The occasion requires not less but more liquid, preferably brown, well-aged, and with a splash of soda." I strode towards the house.
"Indeed, sir," he said, matching me step for step. "I will be pleased to prepare it for you."
"Do so, Greaves," I said, as we crossed the threshold, shedding my rain gear. "And be not parsimonious in the dispensing."
"As you wish, sir."
Moments later, in the drawing-room, he handed me a beaker of the best. I quaffed half in one swallow, took a breath, then downed the rest. I extended the glass to Greaves and said, "Another is called for, I think."
"Indeed, sir," he said, gliding over to the drinks cabinet to repeat the miracle.
"And then," I said, "some thinking must ensue." He returned with the whiskey.
"Yes, sir. If I may say so, I have taken the liberty of examining the records stored in the library, and I believe I can provide grist for the mill."
I might have mentioned before that Greaves is a great one for the information gathering. Little that has happened since Adam was a ball of clay has escaped his attention. Say on, Greaves, I told him, taking a seat and doing justice to the drink. I was surprised that Baldy should have bothered to stock a decent single malt. Carrot juice was more his line of country, but Greaves soon cleared up that minor point, along with some more salient issues. It seemed that the house in which we stood, actually I sat while Greaves paced and recounted the fruits of his researches, had been built by none other than Hudibras Gilatley, a newt boffin. Baldy, arriving to give the professor the benefit of his views, had found it empty and simply moved in. I take it that once he was exposed to the climate, this Gilatley fellow realized that the game was not worth the candle, I said. He departed for sunnier climes? Apparently not, sir, was the answer. It seems that Professor Gilatley mysteriously disappeared while still in the midst of a research project focused on the pond outside. But he published his initial observations in the Journal of Salamandridae Studies, of which he was the editor. Mr. Spots Binkle read the article and immediately wrote to the author. When his telegram was returned as undeliverable, he took umbrage and came to Venus to make his points in person. A picture was beginning to emerge, though I could not quite bring it into focus. "Is there more, Greaves?" I said. "Indeed there is, sir." His face took on a cast that I recognized. There was not only more, but the more was a pip. I bade him say on, and braced myself for the fall of the other shoe. Professor Gilatley's notes were written in a gentlemanly hand. He began. "In other words, nearly unreadable?" I offered. "Very nearly, sir, but I was able to decipher much of them. His work was focusing on a new species he had named Veneria salamandridae sirenae, especially on the creature's reproductive habits." "I say," I said, remembering Shilistrata's limberness. "Something saucy?" "No, sir. To the contrary, the species is parthenogenetic." I grasped at a passing straw. "Persians?" "No, sir. If I may presume to correct you, the term comes from the Greek word for a maiden, parthenos, and denotes a method of reproduction in which the female plays all the necessary roles without benefit of male participation." "Oh," I said. "Not very sporting, if you ask me." "Indeed not. No sport at all, sir." We seemed to have wandered down a byway. I sought to bring us back to the main thoroughfare. "What's this got to do with Baldy?" "Mr. Spots Binkle has taken up the torch where Professor Gilatley let it fall, sir," Greaves said. "He has continued to study reproduction among the V. salamandridae sirenae. He has been fortunate not to suffer the same fate as his predecessor." "Eh?" I said. "I thought that was a mystery." "It was, sir," he said, "until I examined the evidence." "Well, well done, Greaves," I said. "They haven't yet devised the plot you can't fathom. That Christie woman should put you on a retainer." "Very kind of you to say, sir." "Not at all. Credit where credit's due. So what's it all about, then?" "The crucial clue, sir, was in the creature's name, specifically the Sirenae cognomen." The term rang a faint bell. "Something to do with that Ulysses chap and beeswax," I said. "Indeed, sir. Ulysses put wax in the ears of his fellow sailors, then had them chain him to the mast while they rowed the ship past the Isles of the Sirens, whose irresistible song drew hapless mariners onto wave-washed rocks." "Irresistible song, Greaves? You mean like that catchy little ditty Shilistrata was humming?" "Exactly like, sir." The picture was becoming clear now, and a dire vista it made. "She was trying to lure me?" "Into the pond, sir, where she would have, if you'll pardon my plain speaking, immersed you in the ooze and laid her eggs in every available orifice." "Oh, I say, Greaves!"
A fate worse than death.
I'm sorry to contradict you, sir. Death would have come before the egg-laying, by drowning, as it no doubt did for Professor Gelatley.
You haven't seen any beeswax lying about, have you, Greaves?
I looked around, as if some might be conveniently to hand.
Again, sir, I must correct you,
Greaves said.
Blaze away, Greaves. The floor is yours.
Wax will not serve, sir, because the creature Mr. Spotsbinkle has named Chilistrata communicates by mental telepathy.
Reads minds, you mean?
I cannot vouch for the reading, sir, he said. Her mentation is not like ours, but certainly she broadcasts a strong signal.
That humming, I said, rather compelling.
Indeed, sir.
I dwelt upon the matter for a few moments while allowing more of the flavour of peat and heather to do their salutary work. Then a thought struck. But you, Greaves, were not affected. It was as if your mental ears were stuffed with wax.
My mind was on other things, sir, he said, most particularly your safety.
Ah, I said, and, well,
after a moment I added, thank you, Greaves. Not at all, sir.
Is there more?
A little, sir. It would seem that Chilistrata, having fulfilled her biological destiny with Professor Gelatley, again came into season and began seeking a new host for her young. Mr. Spotsbinkle presented himself, and she began the process of, if I may speak bluntly, reeling him in. But then she decided, for reasons only she could know, that he was unsuitable. She decided to wait for a better prospect.
Slithy Tove Whipley wouldn't do? It seemed to me that there was more than a meal or two to be made of Slithy's meaty frame.
The gentleman does not go near the pond, Greaves said, and has not been aboard the rocket ship since we landed.
Probably just as well, I said. I finished my whisky and rubbed decisive palms together. Well, I said, I suppose we'd better go and break the bad news to Baldy.
I'll give you bad news, said Baldy from the doorway. And you can have a broken bone or two while I'm at it.
Ah, Baldy, what-ho? I said.
Don't you what-ho me, he said, advancing into the room.
I had an odd sense of déjà vu, as if I'd recently heard just those words, though I couldn't quite place where. But Spotsbinkle's next utterance drove the question from my mind.
You conniving hound! You treacherous cheat! You cad!
I raised an eyebrow, then another.
I say, Baldy, steady on. I'm steady enough, he answered.
For the first time in our long acquaintance, I saw colour in Archibald Spotsbinkle's countenance. Two bright red spots at about the height of his cheekbones, like an ageing actress who has dipped once too often into the rouge pot.
Steady enough to break your eye and blacken your nose.
I think you'll find you mean, I began, but he spoke over me in a most un-Baldy-like way.
I mean to batter you into a shapeless mass, then trample you into the carpet, he said.
But I'm just about to save your life.
Save your own, he said, if you can.
He had balled his knobbly hands into fists, and now he raised one as if he knew how to use it. I remembered again the short, sharp set-to with Basher Bass Humptington in the junior boys' cloakroom, and recalled that though Baldy had been deficient in the technical aspects, he had not lacked for energy. I moved to put an obstructing sofa between us. But he was not to be stayed by sofas. He leapt onto the cushions, still brandishing his fist, and now he did so from the advantage of greater height. Suddenly, the likelihood of Baldy's doing actual damage grew less remote.
"I say, Spotsbinkle," I said, "what's all this about?" "It's about treachery and double-dealing, and a man I thought was a friend behaving like a worm."
Greaves, who had been standing by, quiet as a statue, now spoke. "May I inquire, sir, if it concerns the person you have named Chilistrata?"
"He knows it does," Baldy said, without taking his feverish eyes from mine. He was supposed to speak to her for me. Instead, he spoke for himself. "I praised you to the skies," I protested. "I called you a winner and a first-rater among newt-men. I counseled her to seize the day before some other newtess claimed you for her own."
He still loomed over me, but the homicidal mania had lost some of its pep. He resembled a Viking berserker who had paused to take thought. His gaze slid towards Greaves.
"Is this true, Greaves?"
"It is, sir."
"But when I went to her just now," Baldy said, climbing down from the cushions, "she spurned me. 'Bring me Bartholomew,' she said. 'I must have him.'"
"Well, she's not getting me, nor any part thereof," I said. "One shudders to think—"
"That's enough of that sort of talk," said Baldy, his colour, however localised, rising again. "One does not speak thus of the woman I intend to wed."
"Baldy," I said, casting about for a clear avenue of approach, "it's not a stroll down the petal-strewn aisle she has in mind." Again, the dismissive digits.
"Oh, I know there are differences between us," he said.
"Know them better than most, I'd say, but with goodwill and growing affection, I'm sure they can be overcome.
Baldy, I won't hear any more against her."
I made a silent appeal to Greaves via eyebrows and corners of the mouth. Baldy has always had a high regard for his acumen. As good souls will, Greaves filled the gap in the line.
"Mr. Spots Binkle," he said, "it grieves me to be the bearer of unhappy tidings, but the lady in question is not seeking a mate. Rather, she is thinking in terms of, shall we say, support for her children."
"I understand that, Greaves," Baldy said, "and I've assured her that my resources will be at their disposal. I mean, what's the use of having a bob or two if you don't use it to do some good?"
"It is not wealth, sir, that is sought," Greaves said. "It is the candidate's more immediate assets that the Sirenae has in view."
"Baldy," I said, "she means to drown me and bury me in the ooze at the bottom of the pond while her grubs, or whatever they are, feast upon my rotting carcass."
As Greaves and I fed him the true gen, he once again defaulted to that pop-eyed, slow-blinking Baldy that is the classic model. After a pause to take it all in, he said, "I don't believe it."
"She prefers Mr. Gloucester," Greaves said, "because, as with Hudibrasque Latterly, who suffered the same fate, his form is more fleshy." He turned to me. "If you will permit my saying so, sir."
"Not at all, Greaves. There is more on the Gloucester bones than on the Spots Binkles. Luck of the draw in the parentage department, probably."
There ensued another period of Baldy's blinking, accompanied by the up-and-down course of his Adam's apple, as he metaphorically, if that's the word, swallowed the bitter pill of truth. Then he spat it out.
"I don't believe a word of it."
He dismissed me with a curl of the lip and rounded on Greaves.
"For once, Greaves, you've misread the cues, followed the tracks up the wrong path."
"I am sorry, sir, that you think so. Professor Galatelli's notes were quite detailed."
"Pah! Him?"
Greaves produced a bound notebook. He wrote, sir, and I quote,
"I will endeavour to ascertain the range of the creature's mesmeric influence, placing a series of white stakes in the turf. I will begin with the distance at which I feel the first mental itch, then proceed to the point at which it becomes almost irresistible."
Greaves offered Baldy a view of the page.
"As you'll see, sir, that was his last entry."
"That could mean anything, Greaves."
"I think you'll find, sir, that it means the professor advanced a stake too far."
"By Jove, Baldy," I said, "Greaves has cinched it again. I saw those stakes in a line down towards the water, with the last few all in a higgle and piggle. That must be the locus delecti, or whatever the Latin is, for the spot where she did the dirty on old Galatterly."
"That was my surmise too, sir," said Greaves.
The two of us had clearly hung Baldy on the horns of a dilemma.
Clearly, he did not want to wave in the news that his inamorata was an aquatic Nosferatu, if that's the fellow I'm thinking of. But Greaves's air of quiet confidence, coupled with the evidence of the stakes, was undermining his defences. "If I may make a suggestion, sirs," Greaves now said, "we should depart at the earliest opportunity. Professor Gelatoli's notes also indicate that there are several other females of the species in the vicinity, some of them considerably larger than the one we have been discussing. I fear that our presence has drawn them towards the house. Mr. Tove Whipley went to see if he could launch the rocket and bring it to this side of the stream. The fact that he has not done so indicates that our situation grows dire." Baldy, by this point, had lost the knack of taking action. He seemed to be contemplating some bleak inner vista, probably involving his inevitable homecoming conversation with Marilyn Spots Binkle, nay Buffett, that was robbing him of whatever was needed to cause him to buck up and soldier on. It was time for a Gloucester to take charge. "Would you see about the packing, Greaves?"
"If I may, sir, I would advise a more precipitous departure. Night is falling, and the creatures grow more restive in the hours of darkness."
"Right-ho, Greaves. All hands, abandon ship." Then a thought occurred. "If we've lost Slithy, who will operate the rocket?"
"I closely observed Mr. Tove Whipley's activities on the outward voyage, sir," Greaves said. "I believe the task is not one that would pose difficulties to an agile mind."
"You think I'll be able to manage a take-off, Greaves?" I said.
"I was thinking rather, sir, that you would minister to Mr. Spots Binkle."
"Ah, yes," I said, regarding the proposed object of my tender care. "Baldy, are you with us?" But Baldy was present in name only. He had even stopped blinking. Greaves proposed that we should each take an arm and walk him towards the rocket ship. I agreed, and we took up our stations and proceeded towards the door. But then Greaves bade us stop and went to the drinks cabinet, where he snaffled up a large bottle of something. "Good thinking, Greaves," I said. "I'm sure we'll need a stiffener somewhere along the line."
"Indeed, sir," he said.
"Now, sir, if I might advocate a certain rapidity of gait?" "Advocate away, Greaves. I'm with you." Then, as we went through the door onto the mossy lawn, I let out a short note of laughter.
"Sir?"
"I just thought, Greaves. Well, what we're doing with poor old Baldy?"
"The situation excites humour, sir."
"Well," I said, savouring the moment to come, "it's a frog march, isn't it? I mean to say, frogs, newts, march, marsh. It works on many levels."
"Indeed, sir. Most droll.
Now we are coming within range. If I may recommend that you concentrate your mind in a way that will resist the female's siren call. A brick wall, perhaps, or large earmuffs."
"Oh, for beeswax, eh, Greaves?" I said.
"Oh, indeed, sir." But then his voice faded into the background cacophony that was rising all around us. The swamp dwellers letting the night know that they were all present and open for business. We struggled on, with Baldy doing a rather convincing impression of a sack of potatoes between us, angling our course away from the pond towards where the little bridge spanned the stream that trickled through the marsh. Beyond the stone arch, on the swamp's only other elevation, I could see the dull sheen of Slithy's rocket ship. Its hatch was open, with a bit of a ladder leading up to it. As we neared the crossing, I felt a tickling between my ears. I'd been expecting another rendition of the slow and sultry number Shilistrata had been playing at our earlier tryst. But it seemed that, in the presence of other anglers, she had gone for a straightforward gaffing of the Gloucester fish. The tickle grew quickly into an unbearable itch. I would have gladly torn off the top of my skull just for a chance to scratch it. Accompanying the maddening sensation was the certain knowledge that it would stop the moment I turned towards the pond.
"I say, Greaves," I said, "I've got this awful
itch, sir," he said, and I saw that his face was almost registering a strong expression, rather like one of Hesiod's Titans acknowledging an earache.
"An itch to end all itches," I said.
Very apt, sir, inasmuch as giving in to it would soon bring about the end of existence.
I believe I'll put it out of my mind, Greaves.
Do endeavour to do so, sir, he said, although I fear it is about to become more difficult. He had only his chin to point with, like Achilles before the walls of Troy, and he used the appendage to indicate that Chilistrata had come out of the pond to take up a position at the near end of the bridge. She had spread her arms wide to bar our passage while narrowing her eyes to slits. She was also giving us an uninhibited view of those rows of glistening needles along her pale pink gums.
"Sirening be dashed!" I said, the itch in my brain having suddenly ceased. "She's going for brute force."
"More than that, sir," Greaves said. "Professor Gelatterly believed that the creature's bite is poisoned."
I said, "so simply booting her out of the way will invite peril."
"Hence this, sir." He raised his free arm, which contained the item he'd picked up from the drinks cabinet.
"Planning to render her squiffy?" I said.
"No, sir," he said, advancing on the new tests, with Baldy and me perforce marching in his train. When we neared the hissing creature, Greaves let fly. It seemed that he had not brought along a flagon of Gelatterly's hooch, but the full soda bottle. He now depressed its lever and sprayed Chilistrata from her head to her non-existent navel with a stream of clear, bubbly liquid. One often sees soda bottles thus used in the cinema, where, along with the tossing of custard pies, they are a staple of Mr. Sennett's comedies. On the new Tess, however, the effect was more in a tragic vein. Where the sparkling water touched her, her green skin turned first a pale yellow, then bleached to a leprous white. Her hiss became a yawp. She scrubbed at her front with her paws, and the contact made her paws exhibit the same colour change. She bent over, emitted a series of yips, and abandoned her bridge-blockading strategy in favour of a quick plunge back into the pond. Greaves and I, with Baldy still hung between us like an oddly shaped rug on a clothesline, tramped onto the bridge. But at the far end we saw a new obstacle. Another new Tess, big enough to make Chilistrata look like the runt of the litter, had dredged herself up from the creek and was giving us the same dentist's eye view of her pointed gnashers. "Onward, sir, if you please," Greaves recommended, and we thundered down the slope of the arch like a three-man version of the Scots Greys charge at Waterloo, a painting of which my Aunt Dahlia had over her bed. Greaves gave the enemy a thorough dousing with soda water, with much the same effect as on the first occasion. In a moment, the way lay clear, and we crossed to dry, well, dryish, land, and struggled up the slope to where the rocket stood.
"That's the spirit, Greaves," I said.
"I regret, sir, that the curtain is not yet down," he said, waving the bottle to indicate that a passel of newts was rising from the water to pursue us. "May I again counsel speed, sir?"
"No need," said I, putting on the best I was capable of.
Together we slogged up to the top of the knoll and thrust Baldy bodily through the hatch. "After you, sir," Greaves said, as he turned to play Horatio at the bridge.
"Never you mind that," I said, taking the soda bottle from him. "Go in and get the engine warmed up, or whatever one does."
A gape-mouthed new Tess hove into view, and I let her have a splash of soda large enough to have ruined a snifterful. Another one came right behind her, and I let fly again. The same colour change and expression of horror came over both of them, and they beetled off to wherever they'd come from.
"Don't care for it at all, do they, Greaves?" I called over my shoulder.
I could hear clicks and flicks from behind me as he did things with the ship's controls. "Their skins are covered in an acidic slime," he said as he continued to work. "The bicarbonate of soda neutralizes the acidity, causing them much the same discomfort as you and I would feel if someone poured acid on us."
I gave another comer a face full of fizz. "I say, Greaves," I said, "we're running low on soda."
I heard a fresh series of switch snappings. Then I felt two strong hands under my arms. "Please forgive my manhandling you, sir," he said, as he hoisted me backwards through the hatch and kicked the door closed. He led me to a sort of chaise longue, fitted with straps and buckles, and made me secure, then did the same for Baldy. Something banged on the hatch. "If I may, sir," he said, gesturing to the control console. "Please, Greaves," I said. "Venus has lost whatever charms it may once have held." He sat in a chair and moved a lever. The ship began to vibrate. Then I began to feel strangely heavy. Sometime later, Greaves hove into view with a pot of tea and the necessary accoutrements. He undid my buckles, then informed me that he had administered a draught of the sleeping potion to Baldy, who would now lie in the arms of that Morpheus chap throughout the long journey home. "Would you care to sleep too, sir?" he asked. "Wouldn't that leave you all alone for, I don't know, weeks?" "Months, sir, in fact." "Good grief in garters, Greaves! I couldn't let you do that all alone." "Very good of you, sir." I took a sip of the brew and thought for a moment, then said, "Greaves, I came to Venus because Slithy Tove Whipley slipped me a mickey, but how did he trick you?" "The gentleman did not trick me, sir. When I saw that he meant to abscond with you, I insisted that he take me too." "Wide awake, Greaves?" "Indeed, sir." "Must have been a dashed boring trip, though, eh?" "Mr. Tove Whipley was kind enough to teach me a card game called Pinochle. He learned it while working with Mr. Ford in America." "Good game, Greaves?" "Quite engaging, sir. And even when played for small stakes, the winnings from several months of constant Pinochle playing can add up." "Won a packet, did you, Greaves?"
"I won the Lulu, sir."
"The Lulu?"
"It is the name of this rocket ship, sir." He took thought for a moment. "Though I may change it."
"Good for you, Greaves," I said. "Now, how about one more cup of tea, and then we'll cut the cards?"
"Very good, sir."
"And Greaves?"
"Yes, sir."
"Thank you for—" I made a gesture that took in all of Venus and its manifold trials.
"Not at all, sir."
Gwyneth Jones. Here's the story of an intrepid explorer who volunteers to be the test subject for a radical new scientific experiment and finds himself very far away from home and up to his hips in trouble. One of the most acclaimed British writers of her generation, Gwyneth Jones was a co-winner of the James Tiptree Jr. Award for work exploring genre issues in science fiction with her 1991 novel, The White Queen, and has also won the Arthur C. Clarke Award with her novel Bold as Love, as well as receiving two World Fantasy Awards for her story The Grass Princess and her collection Seven Tales and a Fable. Her other books include the novels North Wind, Flower Dust, Escape Plans, Divine Endurance, Phoenix Cafe, Castles Made of Sand, Stone Free, Midnight Lamp, Kairos, Life, Water in the Air, The Influence of Ironwood, The Exchange, Deer Hill, The Hidden Ones, and Rainbow Bridge, as well as more than 16 young adult novels published under the name Anne Hallam. Her too infrequent short fiction has appeared in Interzone, Asimov's Science Fiction, Off Limits, and in other magazines and anthologies, and has been collected in Identifying the Object, a collection of short stories. She is also the author of the critical study Deconstructing the Starships, Science, Fiction, and Reality. Her most recent books are a new SF novel, Spirit, or The Princess of Bois Dormant, and two collections, The Buonarroti Quartet and The Universe of Things. She lives in Brighton, England, with her husband, her son, and a Burmese cat.
A Planet Called Desire by Gwyneth Jones. Read for you by Jake Stormone. Chapter 1. John Forrest, Adventurer. The laboratory was on an upper floor, Its wide windows looked out across the landscaped grounds of the Foundation to the Atlantic Ocean. One brilliant star, bright as a tiny full moon, shone above the horizon, glittering in the afterwash of sunset. "My grandfather's people called her Hawa," said the scientist.
"Is that a Dogon term, Patolo?"
asked John Forrest, a big man, fit and tanned, past 40 but in excellent shape. He wore a neatly trimmed beard and mustache, his vigorous red-brown hair brushed back and a little long. His challenging eyes were an opaque dark blue.
"You're Dogon, aren't you?"
They were alone in the lab, alone in the building aside from a few security guards. Dr. Seven Patolo, slight and dark, fragile and very young-looking beside the magnate, was uncomfortable with the situation, but there was nothing he could do. Mr. Forrest, the multi-billionaire, celebrity, entrepreneur, philanthropist, environmentalist, lover of life-threatening He-Man stunts, owned the Foundation outright. His billions financed Patolo's work, and he was ruthless with any hint of opposition. Patolo shook his head.
"I'm afraid my ancestry is mixed. Cameroon is a melting pot. My maternal grandfather spoke one of the vanishing languages of the coast. But Hawa is a loan word. I think it's Arabic and means desire."
"Sensual desire, yes," agreed Forrest. "The temptation of Eve."
He turned to survey the untried experimental apparatus.
"What will conditions be like?"
"Conditions on the surface could be remarkably Earth-like," said Patolo. "The tectonic plate system hasn't yet broken down. The oceans haven't boiled away. Atmospheric pressure hasn't started to skyrocket. The atmosphere is oxygenated. Rotation should be speedier, too. Much longer than our 24-hour cycle, but a day and night won't last a local year."
Forrest studied the rig. Most of it was indecipherable, aside from the scanning gate and biomedical monitors introduced for his benefit. A black globe with an oily sheen, clutched in robotic grippers inside a clear chamber, caught his eye, reminding him somehow of the business part of a nuclear reactor.
"But no guarantees," he remarked dryly.
"No guarantees. Mr. Forrest, you have signed your life away. Neither your heirs nor any other interested parties will have any legal recourse if you fail to return. But the risks are outrageous. Won't you reconsider?"
"Consider what?"
Forrest's muddy blue eyes blazed.
"Living out my life in some protected enclave of a world I'd rather go blind than see? The trees are dying, the oceans are poisoned. We're choking on our own emissions in the midst of a mass extinction caused by our numbers while sleepwalking into a third world war. No, I will not reconsider. Don't tell me about risk. I know about risk."
Patolo nodded carefully, more physically intimidated than he liked to admit by this big, rich white man, disinhibited by great power and famous for his reckless temper.
"My apologies. Shall we proceed?"
"I take nothing. No helmet full of gizmos, no homing beacon."
"Only the capsule you swallowed. If conditions are as we hope, the probe will be retrieved, bringing you along with it. There'll be an interval. I can't tell you exactly how long. The variables are complex. You don't have to do anything. You can move around, admire the scenery, then suddenly you'll be back here."
"Amusing, if I'm in the middle of a conversation. One more question. You've staked your career on this, Patolo, as much as I'm staking my life. What's in it for you?"
"Habitable zones," said the scientist. "Ancient Venus is, in effect, our nearest accessible exoplanet. If we can confirm the existence in space-time of the Venusian habitable zone we've detected, that's a major confirmation of our ability to identify viable alternate Earths. We may not be able to use this method to send probes across the light years to distant systems. There may be insuperable barriers to that, but..."
"Bullshit. Your motive was glory, and the glory is mine now."
Forrest grinned.
"You lose, I win. That's what I do, Patolo.
I see an opportunity and I take it. Are you quite ready, Mr. Forrest?
I am.
Forrest assumed the position, standing in the gate, arms loosely by his sides. He turned his head for a last glance at that bright star. The world disappeared. He stood in a rosy, green-tinged twilight, surrounded by trees. Most seemed young. Some had boles thicker than his body. Fronds like hanging moss hung around him. The ground underfoot was springy and a little uncertain, as if composed entirely of supple, matted roots. No glimpse of sky. The air was still, neither warm nor cold. The silence was absolute, uncanny. He looked at himself, checked the contents of belt loops and pockets. He was dressed as he had been in West Africa, complete with a sturdy, familiar outdoors kit. This struck him as very strange suddenly, but why not? What is a body but a suit of clothes, another layer of the mind's adornment? And his body seemed to have made the trip, or the translation, or whatever you called it. No pack. Patolo had told him he couldn't carry a pack. Patolo! The name rang like a bell, reminding him just what had happened. What an extraordinary feat! He took a few steps, in one direction, then another, keeping himself oriented on the drop zone. Pity he didn't have a ballpark figure for the interval. 10 minutes or 10 hours? How far was it safe to stray? Gray-green bowls crowded him, the hulk of a dead giant or two lurking back in the ranks. He suddenly wondered if he was dreaming. Yes, probably he was. The Patolo narrative, the apparatus, the act of standing in that gate, feeling absurd in his wilderness kit, folded up like a telescope, became implausible as a dream. Only the twilight jungle remained concrete. But how did he get here? He heard nothing. He simply became aware of a rush of small, purposeful movement closing in. The creatures were highly camouflaged, about the size of ground squirrels. Long, flexible snouts, shaggy, apparently limbless bodies. Their swift appearance seemed uncanny. The dream turned to nightmare. But of course they had smelt his blood. He fled, grabbing at appropriate defense, spun around, and pepper-sprayed them. Which did the trick. Hell, they weren't armor-plated, and they liked the taste of their own kind. A useful trait in aggressive vermin. Inevitably, the drop zone was now out of sight, but before he could think about that, a new player arrived. Shaggy, four-legged things. Bigger than the first guys, and smart, organized pack hunters. He ran, but they had him outflanked. Forced to climb, he shot up the first 3 or 4 meters of his chosen refuge in seconds, and went on climbing, easy work, to a knot of boughs high above the ground. There he perched, assembling his pellet gun, thrumming with adrenaline, and almost laughing out loud. An exhilarating place, this planet called Desire. No pack, and no effective firearms. A lack he might come to regret. He was equipped for the wilderness, but not for slaughter. How do you say, I come in peace, to a pack of Venusian hyenas? He saw formidable teeth, and hoped his armory was sufficient. But apparently Venusian hyenas couldn't climb. The brutes circled, panting in frustration, then retreated, vanishing into the dim ranks of the trees. Not worth it, muttered Forrest. Or I smell wrong, unappetizing. He took stock of his situation. Treed in a trackless forest full of hungry predators, some 2 or 3 billion years and around 38 million kilometers from home, and noticed that his secret burden of depression, the black dog mood that had haunted him for years, had vanished. Savoring Patolo's crowning moment, he wondered if he might be here for days. He'd need food, water, shelter, some way to defeat beasts that could tear him apart. The challenges he might face, possibly fatal, possibly insurmountable, delighted him. He was debating whether to take the gun apart or carry it down assembled when a severe, numbing pain alerted him to the tree's behavior. He bared his right leg and saw gray, noduled strands tightly wrapped around his calf. The knot of boughs had produced suckers and sent them to feed, stealthily creeping inside his pant leg. Forrest grabbed his knife and slashed. The pain was unmistakably deep and compelling. There was venom involved, and no time to lose. The suckers fell away. He slashed again at a row of puckered wounds, like scribbled smiley faces opening a long gash in the hope of bleeding the poison out. Too late. In the act of securing a tourniquet below the knee, he stopped being able to breathe, lost consciousness, lost his balance, and fell. He woke on his back, lying on some kind of bed, a very warm coverlet confining him. He smelled foul meat and remembered being dragged through darkness, maybe in the teeth of those hyenas, in a red mist of pain. The pain was still intense, and there were other discomforts, possibly broken bones, but hyenas hadn't brought him here, wherever here was. Flickering light showed a hollow, interior space, crudely furnished. There was someone with him, a figure squatting by a firebowl, poring over small objects on a slab. Silvery fingers rearranged the items. A sleek, bent head pondered the pattern. He was sure he'd seen the same thing before, far away in another world. She's telling my fortune, he thought, though how he knew the figure was female, he had no idea. The items were swept away and vanished. The figure sat back, murmuring, looking down into upturned palms, seeming to engage in a dialogue with the unseen. He slept again. The pain burned low, like a smothered fire. When he next woke, she was by his couch in a very unhuman posture. Good, she said. You're awake. Your head is clear. He nodded, staring. He had been rescued by a glistening, greenish woman with a muscular, sheeny tail, which she was using as a third lower limb, a hairless head, and bird or snake-like features. Green eyes that filled the face, a long mouth with an eerie curl, glint of needle teeth. She spoke, and he understood her. He must be dreaming after all. Your fall saved your life, at a cost. I have set your broken bones. The venom is overcome, but the nibbler bite itself is now urgent. Rotten flesh must be excised, regeneration triggers implanted. You should know. I can immobilize you. I can give you analgesics, but I can't put you out. She showed him her palm. He saw moving symbols. I can read your cell signature on this, but not the details of its expression, and anesthesia is complex. I might kill you. You are a medicine woman, said John Forrest slowly. Yes. Her eerie mouth curled further until he thought her jaw would split from her face. I am indeed. The procedure will be very painful.
Go ahead and operate, doctor. Do I need to sign anything?
Not necessary.
The operation was a success. When pain was once more a smothered fire, she told him all was well and he would soon mend. She asked him where he'd come from.
From the sky, said Forrest. Does it matter?
Not to me, said Lizard Woman, her long mouth curling. He noticed at last a spidery transparent headset and a mic by her mouth, catching gleams of firelight. He raised an arm, the one that wasn't still immobilized by the heated coverlet.
What's that? He muttered, incredulous. Some kind of babblefish?
Yes, sir. It's a translation device. It may look old-fashioned and clumsy, but it converts my language into yours, and yours into mine, adequately enough. Mr. From the Sky, I have business that cannot wait. When you can walk, I'll take you to a better-equipped refuge where you may rest and recover in safety.
Forrest decided that he wasn't dreaming. He was on ancient Venus, and his rescuer was a sophisticated Venusian, an unexpected bonus. She had some rationale to account for his odd anatomy and strange arrival. Fine, he would let her be. He had no urgent need to explain himself. He couldn't gauge how long he'd been in this cave, not even by the growth of his beard, which she had kept close trimmed. But he could assume the retrieval had failed. Probably he was too far from the drop zone. He wasn't overly concerned. Patola would certainly keep trying.
All Forrest had to do was get himself back to the zone before the orbits of the two planets veered too wildly apart. She walked him up and down. She showed him the wellspring, a water supply tapped from the root system of the trees, and explained how to operate a fireball. The flames were natural gas from the same source. How to use the gourd-like ration packs. Her tone was always frosty, if translated emotional nuance could be trusted, her conversation minimal. Forrest surmised, amused, that whoever he was supposed to be, in local terms, was a bad guy in her reckoning, temporarily protected by her Phoenician Hippocratic oath. They left the cave via a twisting crawlspace passage, waking nightmare memories for Forrest, and emerged from a hole in a huge dead root. Her refuge was the hollow under a giant tree stump. She led the way, Forrest stumped behind, favoring his lame leg. He'd tried to convince her to take him back where she'd found him, to no avail, and he was angry. But not such a fool as to strike out on his own against her will. If Lizard Woman had dragged him below herself, she was extremely strong. Or had confederates he hadn't met. Or both, of course. She was alone, living on gourds of mush, but implanted with impressive tech. What was the story? Who was Forrest supposed to be? So many unknowns, and he'd have relished them except that he was so annoyed. But her pace started to tell. She had the pack, he carried nothing, which he found galling. If there were trails, she didn't use them. If she had transport, she preferred to hike. What was she? Some kind of Venusian backwoods survivalist, humiliating a hated city slicker? He refused to be outdone. When she handed him one of those sappy gruel gourds, he emptied it without breaking stride. But it got to be desperate work. She wore a floating gray robe, under it a shirt, and pants that accommodated the tail by having no backside. When the robe lifted as she crossed some obstacle, he saw the big gleaming root of her tail, and it was sexy in a weird way. Before long, her tail was the only thing that kept him moving. Dizzy with exhaustion, he picked at his itching fingertips, trying to extricate a tiny, wriggling brown worm or caterpillar from under one of his fingernails. He didn't know he'd stopped until Lizard Woman was in front of him, taking hold of his wrist. She pulled out her headset and donned it. "Your head swims," she suggested, a cool, contemptuous light in her huge eyes. "Disoriented? Can't think straight? Your skin creeps."
"All of that," mumbled Forrest. "Well done, doctor. You said you would help me."
"I don't believe I did say that, and yet I will."
She was lying. Things only got worse. Now they really went off the piste. Forrest was dragged through virgin thickets, thrown into ditches, forced over mad sastrugi of upheaved root mass, until they reached a small clearing where a new kind of tree, reddish and gnarled, grew with no near neighbors. Stumbling and confused, he was ordered to strip and hustled onto a natural platform among its roots. The lower part of the bowl was scarred. She stuck something in his hand, forced him to grip, and shouted at him. "Stab the tree! Stab it! Over your head! Cover your eyes, okay?" He was holding a knife. He reached up and stabbed the tree. A huge gush of stinging hot liquid burst out and pounded on him. A hot shower, my God! The itching that had been driving him mad, a vile, active sensation over his whole body, leapt to a crescendo. He looked down and saw a nest of little dark worms on his chest. More of them over his belly, his arms. They were wriggling out of his pores, his anus. They were everywhere. There were hundreds of them. The hot, scouring liquid diminished. Frantically, he stabbed the tree again and again. Oh, blessed relief. The first time he left the platform, she sent him back. The second time, she was satisfied and slapped a new kind of soft-walled gourd into his hands. "Hold that. Whatever they gave you, Mr. From the Sky, it doesn't last. You'll have to do as we do in here. Depilate and use barrier methods, or the sippers will overwhelm you in hours."
I'm going to fix you up before you collapse. She made him sit on the ground, massaged a grainy goop into his hair, his beard, his arms and legs, his chest, his pubes, sent him to rinse off, then helped to apply a cream that left his skin shining like her own. There was also breathable gel, she said, as she sleeked his every crevice for nostrils, mouth, and eyes, but it wasn't necessary in the short term. The sippers wouldn't block airways or endanger sight until their host was actually dying. The erection she provoked along the way didn't bother her. She ignored it, and so did he. But there was something between them, when he was hairless, purged, and dressed again, that had not been there before. Since we're talking, sir, what about a name?
Forrest. My name is John Forrest. And you?
Sech-ul.
Sech. That means the woods, doesn't it?
You know my humble language.
He shook his head. In the cave, I sometimes heard you talking to someone, or communing with your gods. I listened. I figured out that Sek meant woods, frequency of occurrence.
He gestured around them.
Since here we are.
I have no gods, she said, and added, Ul means song. The ch is a separating sound. My name is Wood Song. Sek-ul, without the ch, means something different.
The distinction was obviously important, but he wasn't sure how to respond. Wood Song. Okay. John means gift of God.
She laughed. At least the sound she made felt like laughter. His eyes burned. He'd forgotten to cover them. But the world was in focus. He was awake, alive, firing on all cylinders again, maybe for the first time since he'd touched down. He looked at the gouged tree bowl and the shower platform, a natural formation smoothed by long use.
There are people living around here?
There are the indigenes, primitive surface dwellers. You won't see them. A few others. You'll see them even less. Let's go. It's not much farther.
Soon they crossed a really large clearing, and he was able to gauge the height of the frondy canopy at last. Impressive, but not extraordinary. 60 or 70 meters. Only mosses grew on the open ground, but the springy, uncertain feeling stayed the same.
Sech-ul kept to the margin of the trees.
Up ahead, a shadow moved between the canopy and a ceiling of bright cloud. A gray curtain falling under it, defined like a rainstorm seen from afar on a wide plain. Forrest thought they were heading into rain until they crossed the shadow's trajectory, and he stared in amazement at the tangled, mighty underbelly, then flinched and ducked as vagrant shining strands actually brushed his naked skull.
Don't worry, she said.
She'd kept the headset on since his shower bath, a concession he appreciated.
They're just eating air. It doesn't know we're here.
They re-entered the woods, and almost at once she halted, gesturing for him to step well back. A knotted growth, a tumor on a root, stood knee-high in their path.
Sech-ul crouched, her tail balancing her, and cut herself between the fingers of her right hand with the knife he'd borrowed.
Was her blood red? He couldn't tell in this everlasting rosy green twilight.
Wait. Don't move from where you stand.
Following her with his eyes, he saw the same ceremony performed again, farther into the trees on his right.
What was she doing? Placating demons?
Having met some of the demons, he didn't move a muscle until she reappeared from the left. She'd circled round something big. They walked on and stood in the precinct of a truly vast dead giant. A tree stump, tall as a house and broad as a barn. Forrest looked it over with respect.
I hope this guy doesn't feed on flesh. Actually, he does, but the heartwood is inert.
The last section of the entrance tunnel was vertical. They descended a ladder into a room, rounded and domed like the first cave, but far more spacious and better furnished. There were covered couches, low tables, domed chests, a fireball at one focus of the ellipse, a wellspring bubbling at the other.
doorways, closed off, seemed to lead to other areas. Forrest's appetite had returned. He longed for steak, fries, and a good malt, but he made do with another sappy, cruel gourd. He should stop calling them gourds, since they were obviously manufactured. Fell onto a couch and plunged into oblivion.